Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. For this episode, we are joined by Chris Grambling, partner at Southfield Capital, and Kevin Condon, partner at Hidden River Strategic Capital. Today, we'll get their point of view on some of the topics discussed in BDO's recent Private Equity Predictions Insight, including their creative approaches for sourcing deals and the role add-on deals have played recently at both of their firms. We'll also discuss how Chris and Kevin set their portfolio companies up for resilience and a whole lot more. So just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So Chris, let's start with you and your role as a partner at Southfield Capital. Why don't you introduce us to yourself, your firm, explain a bit about your role, and maybe share what Southfield Capital looks for when making investments?
Sure. Thanks for having us, by the way, Todd. Again, this is Chris Grambling. I'm a partner at Southfield Capital, and I'm coming up on about 7 years with Southfield. I've been in lower middle market private equity investing, though, for about the last 13 years or so, and started my career in sell side investment banking for about 4 years. On a quick side note, I got to mention I went to Vanderbilt for undergrad and that they recently beat Kentucky in basketball over the weekend. So quick shout out to them. But as a partner on the investment team, I'm involved in all sorts of aspects of deal sourcing, execution, but really underwriting of the platform acquisitions and working alongside owner operators as it relates to their next 3 to 5 year period with Southfield as their partner. Back on Southfield, though, we're based in Greenwich, Connecticut, with an office in Seattle. We've been around since 2002. We focus entirely on non-discretionary business service companies in the lower middle market. So B2B only, though, nothing consumer oriented. From a size range, that means an initial platform is anywhere from 4 million to 20 million of EBITDA, although our sweet spot's really around 5 to 10 million of EBITDA. We focus on owner-operated businesses, like I mentioned, where we're the first institutional capital. We're not interested in walkaway deals, though. Alignment with founders is critical to our approach. Alignment both on the investment strategy and their role during our hold period, as well as financial alignment with owners as enrolling equity in the same class as Southfield. If they're not going to have a meaningful amount of ownership but are part of the decision-making, then they're not going to be a fit for us. The types of services we look for are critical in nature and often represent a small dollar spend on their customer's P&L. So a customer is more focused on the value the provider offers rather than the lowest cost provider in the market. These businesses have little to no CapEx nor any inventory. So EBITDA really translates to free cash flow. We are growth investors and look for multiple avenues of growth, both organic and through acquisitions. We love fragmented markets with large TAMs where we can expand into new geographies, service offerings, or other adjacencies. All of our investments go through what we call the Southfield J-curve, where top line is often growing in the first few years, but EBITDA sometimes remains flat for the first year or two as we invest in the company's infrastructure and prepare it for accelerated growth. We don't slow down on the investment side, though. We treat any business no different in year five than year one when it comes to hiring the right resources or investing in the right systems. Generally, you know, we have a fantastic group here, a fantastic group of companies and founders as well. And we always encourage owners to reach out to us, past or present, to our founders to get a feel for what it's like to work with us. That's it in a nutshell, though.
All right, Chris, I've hosted many of these podcasts. I think this is episode 49. And you're, I think, the first guest to plug his alma mater and their sports team. So I love it. Maybe we'll need more of that going forward. So I appreciate you being here. So Kevin as well, great to have you. Please tell our listeners a bit about Hidden River Strategic Capital, your role as a partner, and the types of companies you invest in. And certainly feel free to include any sectors you're especially excited about.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Todd. And yep. I probably should start off plugging my alma mater just to make sure everything's even here and say go Badgers. I went to University of Wisconsin and our basketball team is doing relatively well. We haven't knocked off the likes of Kentucky. and I guess also congrats to you and the BDO team on this podcast. It is one of the top PE podcasts of 2025. It's an honor to be a part of it.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Azure's a hidden river. We're a relatively new name in the PE space, based in the Philadelphia suburbs. I started the firm a couple of years ago with two co-founders, Steve Gord and Todd Morrissey. We ended up raising a fund of about $250 million with a focus that we've seen throughout our careers on this underserved niche of the private capital markets. Namely, it's providing customized combinations of flexible debt and non-control equity to support management-owned companies. They're often taking on their first institutional capital. Our structured capital strategy is designed for those situations that call for something that's a little more patient and open-minded than traditional debt, while also being less invasive and dilutive than you would get from traditional equity. We really view it as a best of both worlds approach between the debt world and the equity world, with our ability to creatively tailor our investments to match the needs and objectives of the management teams we partner with. From a size perspective, we really focus on businesses with EBITDAs below $10 million. Though for the right opportunities, we have looked at and will look at some larger companies than that. But really, you think about us as kind of the lower end of the middle market. And we're happy to consider investments anywhere within the continental U.S. and are open to an array of industries and business models. We don't really necessarily focus so much on a sector thematic ways of going to market and particular industries, so much as we narrow the universe by the type of transaction objectives being achieved. We're really looking for an entrepreneur who's trying to grow either organically or through add-on acquisitions, not necessarily the person who's trying to cash out. And it sounds like similar to what Chris and the Southfield guys do. If you're trying to cash out, that's probably not for us. We really want the entrepreneurs looking to double down, and we can provide the support and be their partner in that next stage of their evolution.
Well, Kevin, it's early days for Hidden River, but you and I have known each other for years and back to your prior firm. So it's good to keep the relationship going. And thanks again for joining us. So, Chris, I'm actually going to come back to you before we move on. Perhaps you can share with our listeners how you pinpoint certain industries or niches with untapped potential. Are there particular sectors you're seeing opportunities in as we get further into 2025?
It's a little different for us because we are sector focused. So yeah, we only do business services, but we do research and review, and we do have the thematic investing approach within business services. And the, I think there's 125 plus different subsectors, and then you can get further into each of those. Generally, though, we're looking more around the business model attributes. So what we're looking for is recurring or reoccurring revenue models, strong gross margins. Since we often add a lot of infrastructure to a company, these are pretty raw companies when we first invest. Strong gross margins can also be an indicator of a strong value proposition to their customer. I mentioned consolidation plays in fragmented markets, and we do a lot of add-on acquisitions. In terms of areas we avoid, we don't do anything with stroke of the pen risk, really, where legislation can hurt the company. We're also not trying to build a better mousetrap, so we typically avoid software and SaaS type companies. Generally speaking, though, we have anywhere from 5 to 10 subsectors we're researching at any given time with our team as part of our thematic investing arm. Without sort of divulging any of the ones we're farther along with, I think to give you one that we're looking at in 2025 that excites me, really any way to play around services for an aging infrastructure seems interesting. Both the government and private sectors appear to be prioritizing modernization, which is obviously long overdue, and it's not going to happen overnight. So there's a long runway. There's so many different types of service companies in and around infrastructure, but we're still in our research phase on which pockets we want to pursue. All of this modernization is great and will obviously benefit consumer safety, sustainability, particularly in and around energy and transportation. I should also mention digital connectivity becoming more integrated into nearly everything with IoT. From an investor standpoint, these are, you know, essential services that should offer a stable investment outlook for, like I mentioned, for the foreseeable future.
All right. Well, I appreciate you elaborating on some of those subsectors without giving away any of your secret sauce. So before we get too deep into our headlining topics for today, I did want to ask one more thing here. Kevin, I guess I'll go to you first on this one. Your firms take unique approaches to investing in the middle market. Can each of you take a moment to detail some of the key differences in how your firms operate? So, Kevin, what do you care to share?
Sure. Maybe I just expand a bit further than I was describing earlier, because it would be helpful. As we target this gray area between what a traditional lender would focus on one hand and what a buyout or growth equity firm would focus on the other hand, it's our view that there's really just more than enough lenders in the market today, and it's relatively hard to differentiate between them. And importantly, most credit platforms really focus on supporting the buyout deals of PE sponsors, which is just a different go-to-market strategy and relationship with the underlying company in those sponsor deals than what we focus on the non-sponsored management-owned situations. If you go to the other end of the spectrum, there are lots of PE buyout funds out there, oftentimes fighting over the same deals marketed by sell-side investment banks. Some of those buyout funds have unique angles and differentiation, and Chris talked a little bit about what they do differently within their firm. It's a crowded market. By design, we play in a smaller pond where there's, you know, on one hand, fewer deals that kind of fit the criteria, but there's much less competition due to the fact that there's just far fewer PE firms that predominantly focus on the structured capital space and the management-owned businesses in particular.
Got it. Appreciate that. Chris, what about Southfield Capital? What kind of different benefits might companies see working with your team?
Yeah, I guess just backing up, you know, a big part of why Southfield has been around for the last 22 years is really our founder-friendly approach. It may not sound unique, but in the lower middle market and specifically within the business services industry, people are the product. So as a new investor, you can't come in making changes without full buy-in from the founder and the management team. Otherwise, the workforce will catch in to any kind of hint of dissent of that plan that we've crafted together. You know, one of our core pillars or mottos at Southfield internally is DDS, discuss, decide, and support. And one of the most important parts of that is the support piece. You can't have finger pointing if things don't go to plan. Just creates a recipe for infighting and distrust. But on our companies, we spend as much time as possible prior to close, crafting and collaborating on that 3 to 5 year strategy to ensure the full buy-in. Tactically, we plan out week by week, you know, what the first 100 days post-close looks like. This is communication to employees, customers, vendors. You know, the founder's not going anywhere, and they now have access to resources and capital they weren't previously available, either because the founder didn't want to take on that risk or they didn't know how or what it should look like. So bringing on our 20 plus years of experience investing and really across the investment deal team over 100 years, we've seen it within the business services industry. It could be a different subvertical or sector, but it's very similar. We're also constantly looking to evolve as a firm and improve. 2 years ago, we brought on our transformation partner, Bob Root, to lead and expand our value creation team. We recognized technology needed to become the forefront of our investing approach. As you see, AI and BI tools become more prevalent. So Bob came from a successful career at Procter & Gamble, most recently at Microsoft. And he's really expanded our bench of operating advisors to include technology experts who, you know, we could only have dreamed of partnering with years ago for a lower middle market. These are individuals that tend to work with Fortune 500 type companies. So we found that's really set us apart. And as Kevin mentioned, it's a bit more crowded market where we play.
Yeah, I like the DDS concept. I'll give you credit when I share that internally with my BDO colleagues. Well, we've learned a lot about your firms, which I think is going to be a nice foundation to our conversation. So I'm going to turn the conversation at this point towards deals. So as we move into a period where private equity deal activity is projected to accelerate, what strategies are you using to gain an edge in sourcing high quality deals? And are there any new or creative approaches or competitive tactics that your firms are leveraging? Kevin, I'll throw this one out to you.
Yeah, one of the things we like about fishing in our smaller pond of these hybrid debt equity deals is that we're not quite as impacted in the same way with the shifting tides you described, with deal activity rising or falling necessarily from period to period. We really went into building our firm and investment strategy with the mindset that our approach needed to remain relevant kind of across the economic and credit cycles. And it's been our experience that small owner-operated companies have capital needs for growth and add-on acquisitions or internal recaps that don't necessarily cycle up and down with the typical drivers of the M&A and financing markets, whether that's purchase price multiples or interest rates. That said, our structured capital focus creates some unique opportunities and frankly, challenges just from a sourcing standpoint. They're different than the ways buyout funds or traditional lenders typically source their deals. Just for comparison, kind of in the case of the buyout world, there's an entire ecosystem largely comprised of sell-side investment banks that's set up to feed those types of PE funds their new deal opportunities. And from a lender's perspective, you know, most of the banks and traditional credit funds source their deals by befriending the buyout funds and trying to provide those sponsors with debt financing to support their buyout transactions. For us, it's not quite as simple as calling on the tier A list of investment banks or the tier A list of PE sponsors to find our types of deals. In our world, it's really around a much broader approach to sourcing. For us, the marketing and BD strategy involves planting a lot of seeds across many fields and then nurturing those relationships and building a reputation over long periods of time. Ultimately, our goal is to be top of mind and kind of the group to call for these sorts of capital raises and non-control recap situations. My partners and I, as well as our head of BD, do that really by just constantly working to educate the market on who we are and what we do. And that story gets told over and over to, you know, smaller investment banks, business brokers, and other deal intermediaries, as well as accountants and lawyers and any players in the private capital market ecosystem, frankly. Obviously, none of that's all that novel or exciting, but we found over the course of our careers that it seems to work. And it's really building our sourcing effort with a long-term mindset and kind of independent of the ebbs and flows of M&A activity from time to time.
Gotcha. Well, as a BD guy, I was glad to hear you plug your BD guy. I know Graham at Hidden River and Jason at Southfield Capital both do a great job. So I know you guys have those guys on your bench. Chris, what about you? What creative tactics at Southfield are you guys employing to remain competitive and source high quality deals?
Yeah, I mean, historically, we've been anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 deals per year in review at the top of the funnel. But we're very selective. We only invest in roughly two, maybe three platforms in any given year, and then another 10 to 15 add-ons across the portfolio. 2024 was actually no different. We did complete two platforms. Forget where we shook out on add-ons, roughly 11, despite lower overall market activity. So similar to what Kevin mentioned, our goal is to really maintain enough volume so that we're somewhat insulated by the large market swings up or down. Generally speaking, we have a multiple pronged approach to sourcing, though. You know, anywhere our VPs through partners are in constant communication with the thousands of bankers in the system, most of which only have a relevant deal for us every few years. So it's a lot of outreach, outbound calls, constant contact where, you know, they may have a process. They may only go out, and I'm talking about the smaller intermediaries, they may only go out to 5 to 10 private equity firms that they know have a conviction in that industry or in that market, or they know they're the services one, or they will have a quick answer for them. So there's a little bit of reputation that assists with us getting a look at deals. I mentioned the thematic side as well. You know, we have our internal teams do initial screening and presenting of subsectors within business services, and then they present them to our IC. These are then screened through an initial grading process. Then we flesh them out through external resources with banker calls, you know, consulting GLG experts, industry networking events. And we find that having conviction within a sector before seeing a potential deal really enables us to move faster. And we already speak the industry lingo during an initial meeting with a founder. You know, we're already up to speed on what areas we should be asking about rather than, hey, tell me about your industry and I'm learning as we go type thing. I should also note, we have constant feelers out in the market that might take years to come to fruition. A great example of that is our logistics platform, Alba. I mean, that was nearly 4 years of conversations with the two brother founders before they were ready to bring on a partner. We have plenty of other examples of that in the market and, you know, waiting to come back to us maybe a year or two from now. So not a great way to say we're doing anything unique. Jason, as you mentioned, is in charge of our BD. We attack it from every angle and try and be as competitive as possible.
All right. Well, I appreciate all that color on the topic from both of you. So, Chris, I'm going to stay with you for the next one. As I'm sure you're well aware, resilience has become a critical theme for businesses. So how do you approach ensuring your portfolio companies are prepared to weather potential economic or market disruptions?
So that might be easier for us because of our sector focus. You know, by definition, we only invest in non-discretionary business services companies. So there's often a track record of them historically weathering recessions. If not, that's a little bit of a yellow flag. During COVID, during the pandemic, basically none of our companies had to shut down. They were all deemed essential services. Some of them even grew during the pandemic. Having said that, as you know, it's a lower middle market. As we invest and grow, we always look to diversify. Any lower middle market company is going to have some sort of concentration risk, whether it's customer concentration, key man risk, a single geography, or a single service offering. We identify those risks during our underwriting, and then we try and incorporate and plan for them with solutions to mitigate them during our hold period. Some of those, as an example, almost every company invests in the CEO has many hats, but they tend to hold key customer relationships. We know right away that we need to build out the sales and marketing infrastructure and hire a team, you know, usually with a chief revenue or commercial officer as a leader, and begin transitioning those relationships early on, because that process can't be done overnight, can often take many years. Another way to reduce this reliance is through scale. That's with any of the risks I mentioned. That, you know, CEO or founder might represent 30 to 40% of sales when we first invest, but when the company's triple the size, suddenly that percentage is is a lot smaller and more manageable. I should also note, generally for risk, we are prudent users of leverage. We recognize these are more fragile businesses when we first invest. Often they've never experienced debt or borrowed money, and it's new to them. And we're also investing a lot in the first 2 years. So we don't want to be beholden to credit agreement restrictions. We want to invest knowing that there's that J curve I previously mentioned. Once these businesses have a bit more scale and more institutionalization, they can stretch a little higher if needed. If a larger add-on acquisition comes up, or there's a large, you know, software upgrade or ERP system that we need to invest in, there's a difference between a 5 million EBITDA company versus a 10 to 15 in terms of how much interest and debt service they can handle.
All right, lots of good data points there. How about you, Kevin? How does Hidden River keep Portco resilience top of mind?
I'd probably start with just our kind of a general approach is being pretty conservative with the use of leverage, whether it's debt from us or from a third party senior lender. By not maxing out leverage on the businesses we invest in, we give them the flexibility and really the space to navigate potential economic or market disruptions. And in many of our situations, we're the only lender to the business anyways. And since we have a meaningful equity stake in most of our companies, our approach and really perspective when dealing with potential headwinds differs pretty notably from your traditional lender, who's probably a little more rigid and may not have the patience or long-term mindset to help see a business through to the kind of calmer waters on the other sides of a storm. Beyond that, I think we will consider that kind of capital structure and prudent leverage profile. We also think about, you know, what we could do at a board level to help our management teams and portfolio companies think through the things that they can control or levers they can pull, whether that's around expense management or being thoughtful around spending of CapEx, making sure that they've got a fully built out team and have expanded the team to there's redundancies, and just managing the delicate balance between growth, margins, and cash flow. There are conversations for rosy times and when things are good, and also conversations for weathering those potential economic or market disruptions you described.
I appreciate a lot of good insight there as well. So let's move on and talk about add-on deals. For the last few years, we've seen PE funds leverage add-ons to help solve the valuation problem they've been facing with their longer-held portfolio companies. So curious to hear from both of you regarding how your firms have been using add-ons to their advantage, hopefully, recently. Kevin, I'm going to come back to you to start us off here.
We're pretty big fans of the add-on acquisitions and where appropriate, kind of the roll-up strategies within industries. It's not necessarily from solving a valuation problem or dealing with long-held portfolio companies, but we like just the general theme of growing through add-ons and kind of M&A activity, as well as what we can do organically. In fact, we've actually got two of our portfolio companies right now that are pursuing roll-up strategies in their respective industries, and another one of our platforms that's in active discussions with an add-on. So we're regularly thinking about what we can do beyond just organic growth. And frankly, in the lower middle market, you know, we're believers that you're more often betting on the jockey than the horse, meaning that it's often the management team that makes or breaks the investment rather than the underlying product or service the company is offering. I think Chris touched on that a little bit earlier. As a result, we really find that if we could get a good management team to partner, we want to support them and help them grow their business. Oftentimes that comes through add-ons, which really allows the company to grow into new markets or add adjacent offerings or simply just gaining market share and scale. The fact that they're smaller often does mean that they can be purchased at lower multiples than we may have invested in the larger platform. And that's a nice benefit, but it's probably not the primary motivator for us. The primary motivator of doing that add-on work is really around finding further ways to invest and scale in the great teams that we have in place, really leveraging the leadership and talent of the existing portfolio company.
Yeah. All right, Kevin. Thanks for that. So, Chris, you've already, I guess, hinted at the add-on topic, but what has been Southfield's approach to add-on deals and how have you benefited from them?
Yeah, they've always been a part of our strategy. We're not buying for the sake of buying. We call it internally EBITDA stacking. We're not just trying to create scale. Add-ons have to make strategic sense for the business, and they have to have buy-on from the management team. As I mentioned earlier, culture is incredibly important to service companies, and that can get tricky when you combine two competitors. We often leverage our management teams, since they know the industry the best, on what they hear about reputation and of these targets and if they've hired any employees from them or vice versa. But most importantly, we're looking for a 1+1=3 or even 4 or 5 type situation. That almost never comes from cost cutting, though, since many of the small businesses already run lean. we're underwriting to cross-sell customers through new geographies and service offerings. Two of the companies I've worked with over the last five, 6 years, I guess, Millrose Consultants and Kelvin Group are great examples of using add-ons to the company's advantage. They both sit in industries that are not picked over by private equity involvement. We've been able to be more selective on who we partner with. You know, between the two, we've completed roughly 25 add-ons combined in the last five, 6 years. They both started as regional leaders that have transformed into national players with offices all over the US and expanded into new service offerings, new geographies, new end markets. And we've created national accounts programs at each, which is where you see the most growth. When you hear from a customer that they want you to do work in another region, it makes it that much easier when you acquire something locally to then have additional sales demand ready to convert. It's really fun and exciting stuff to see in our businesses as they transform. I should also note that, you know, at Southfield, we tend to be more involved with M&A in the first year or two, and that's the best way we feel to learn in industries, to really get into it, attend networking events, attend industry events, meet new people, see what they're doing differently and what other service offerings they're providing, things like that. And then as our companies mature, we typically have a head of business development and hire one at the company who works with an internal integration head on all aspects of M&A. So we really try and create a true plug and play for the next potential owner of the business.
All right, guys, that's a ton of insight on add-ons. So I'm sure our listeners picked up quite a bit there. So that brings us to our last topic for today. Each episode, I typically like to give our guests the chance to share their predictions for what's to come. Call it my crystal ball question. So it's the talk of the town. Private equity seems poised for a transformative year, they say. As we enter 2025, what shifts do you foresee in the middle market specifically? You know, how do you expect things could change in light of ongoing market uncertainty, geopolitical challenges, or really just the evolving competitive landscape? Chris, I'm going to let you start us off here. What are your thoughts?
Sure. So, you know, everyone I've talked to seems cautiously optimistic about 2025. I'm in agreement. I think we'd probably be even more bullish if we hadn't heard the same thing, you know, heading into 23 and 24, though.
Right.
What feels different this time, though, is banker backlogs, from what we've heard, are more diversified. You know, a lot of them have said that last year was more dependent on only a handful of sectors holding up overall firm performance and kind of hiding some of the underperformance overall. This year, though, you know, you're hearing more pockets and sectors are coming out that were previously quiet in 23 and 24. That's a great sign. Feels like a matter of when, not if at this point. Some of this may be part of the election uncertainty ending or lower interest rates. Either way, activity should pick up. And in particular, in the middle portion of the middle market, I think you'll see more PE firms that were holding on to their non-A assets feel like it's finally time to test the waters. That'll really open things up for all of private equity as you think about lower middle market to middle market to the upper echelon.
I chuckled when you said it. I think it's a fair comment that we did hear that back in 23 and 24. I would say a nice leading indicator for me in my conversations with clients is that our sell-side QFE practice has really been flat out for the last few months with a bunch of great deals coming to market or that have come to market in the last week or two. So as of now, I remain optimistic. Kevin, how about you? You can round us out. What do you think is on the private equity horizon for 2025? And what challenges is your firm preparing to face?
I wish I could say my crystal ball was all that accurate. I think that must be broken in some way or form. So take my outlook and sentiments with appropriate wariness. But I guess with that disclaimer, I'd say I'd also consider myself to be cautiously optimistic. We're really active right now and expect to continue to see that throughout the year. As we think about the broader market, some of the ambiguity coming post-election, I think is helpful broadly to the market. How that plays out for us in the lower middle market in general is to be seen. But I think there's a lot of excitement with anyone you talk to in the private market ecosystem, from bankers to capital providers. And we've got, you know, the right team in place and the capital at the ready to pursue new platforms as well as these add-ons we were talking about. So we're pretty excited about what lies ahead for all of us and looking forward to a strong 2025.
All right. Well, that's going to do it, guys. I really thank you both for a quite insightful, informative, and thoughtful conversation. You know, on behalf of BDO, we certainly appreciate and value our relationships with Southfield Capital and Hidden River Strategic Capital. I know for a fact you're both busy guys. So thanks again for joining us. And I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, Todd, thanks again for having us. It's been great. Always appreciate BDO as a partner for us. You mentioned your Q of E team. We're keeping them busy a lot, as well as the rest of the folks there. So this has been fun. First time doing the podcast thing. So again, thank you for the invite and always happy to participate when you're around.
Yep, my pleasure.
Yeah, similarly, Todd, we appreciate being part of your world and the BDO partnership that we have with you and the relationship, you know, you and I have had going back probably a dozen years. So thank you for being a part of this, and we look forward to doing more with you guys in the future.
All right, thank you. So to our listeners, thanks so much for listening. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.